This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Fierce fighting continues between Israel and Hezbollah while international efforts to broker a ceasefire progress, but slowly. At the United Nations, there's no agreement on the size, composition, and mandate of an international force for southern Lebanon. Lebanon's acting foreign minister said yesterday he was skeptical that his government would allow a European-led force into the area because of intense opposition to the plan from Hezbollah and from its key backers, Syria and Iran. Since the fighting began over 3 weeks ago, there's been speculation about the extent of Iran's involvement in this conflict. Some believe that Iran must have approved Hezbollah's cross-border raid that triggered the fighting more than 3 weeks ago, though there's no evidence of that. Others describe Israel's response to the attack as a pre-existing plan designed to reduce Iranian influence. Some argue that Iran hopes to divert world attention from efforts to curb its nuclear ambitions, and others say that what we're seeing is a proxy war between Iran and the United States. Our main focus this hour is on Iran, its role in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, and its ambitions on both the regional and the world stage. Later on in the program, PBS President Paula Kerger tells us about her battle with the FCC over indecency fines and the future of public television. But first, if you have questions about Iran's role in this crisis and its possible role in its resolution, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. We begin in Cairo, where New York Times bureau chief is Michael Slackman. He's just back from 10 days in Tehran. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
You wrote in one of your stories for the Times that Tehran is unusually tense these days. What's going on?
Well, the description of Tehran as tense is a combination of both the domestic politics, where recently we've seen kind of a crackdown on political opposition groups, as well as just the general feeling as a result of the war. It's an interesting dynamic in Iran, which is the reverse of the Arab world. In the Arab world, you've seen governments that have been kind of silent. And the implication is that they're eager to see, or at least willing to see, Hezbollah dismantled, while the streets in the Arab world have been very agitated and angry. In fact, the reverse is true in Tehran, where the government has been very outspoken, very supportive of Hezbollah, and the street actually is not.
There are a number of people with whom you spoke who said, this is not our war.
In fact, that's the feeling you get on the street. I have to say the dynamic is changing somewhat as the war goes on and as images of dead civilians, particularly dead children, are playing over and over and over on satellite television. But there's no great love between, to generalize, Iranians and Arabs. And this is not seen as their war. This is seen as the mullah's war, the government's war. There are a lot of problems in Iran. There's huge unemployment. They're talking about rationing gasoline. They're paying something like $7 billion a year to subsidize gasoline in a country that has some of the largest known oil reserves in the world. This frustrates people, and they would like to see their government focus on domestic problems.
And this, of course, comes at a time when world oil prices have spiked, so Iran must be doing pretty well or better than even expected in terms of its income.
Yeah, I mean, again, Iran is just in this unusual position of taking in huge amounts of money, unprecedented. I think somebody told me their income is, for the first time, higher, or the GDP is higher since the Shah, something like that. I'm not an economist. But they don't have refining capacity. So what it means is they have to import gasoline. And so something like 46% of their gasoline is imported. So it's costing them a huge amount of money, and they don't want to pass that cost on to people because it would potentially ignite public distrust.
You also talk about, from the Iranian leadership's point of view, this conflict on two levels, on the ideological level and on the strategic level. And on the ideological level, at least reading your reports, there's a feeling that they think they've already won.
I think we have to just state out flat out that when you're talking about the Iranian leadership, it's very often reading between the lines. That said, yes, there is definitely a growing sense of confidence seeming to emerge. They definitely are projecting this idea that they are assuming the role of the leader of the Muslim world. And they are returning to the ideas of Ayatollah Khomeini, the grandfather of the revolution, which is to export themselves and their revolutionary ideas. And they feel it's working. I think that's somewhat offset, as I said in the story, by also a realization that from a strictly strategic military point of view, there's a recognition that they've been weakened, that there is no longer a very strong opposition force, military opposition force, that they can play, that they can use directly on the border with Israel.
One of the things you said that was interesting was that, in fact, they had hoped Hezbollah would not use all of its assets, not all of the missiles that can range the furthest into Israel, in hopes of retaining some of that deterrent capability. And, of course, Hezbollah getting caught up in the fighting, these things are not always easy to restrain.
Of course. I mean, once again, we're reading between the lines, but over and over and over, what I heard from people with close relationships to the government was that Iran's interest is maintaining a proxy army, a proxy military force on the border with Israel. They believe that Israel has already succeeded in somewhat diminishing that force, how significantly we don't know yet, and also in assessing the capability of that force. Unknown capability they view as a deterrence. And the concern is, and maybe we're beginning to see this already, is the agendas of Hezbollah and Iran diverge at this point. Hezbollah will view itself as simply fighting a war and will need to do and use all of its capabilities. Iran, I'm told, is encouraging them to hold back, to not show all of their cards, so that if the fighting stops, and I think from Iran's perspective, they're looking for that sooner than later, they will maintain some deterrence capability.
And we just heard, I think, in just the last hour, Hassan Nasrallah in an address on Lebanese television, on his station there, talking about threatening to hit Tel Aviv if Beirut is hit. And that, of course, would mean using their longest-range missile that people suspect they've got. And thus far, at least, he's not made empty threats.
Well, again, one of the things that seems to be a divergence of agendas is the escalation of this conflict. It would appear that neither Syria, which was also a backer of Hezbollah, nor Iran really wants it to escalate. It would seem in their interests for a ceasefire where nobody is the clear victor. And if that is the case, then they can certainly boast that, from their perspective, Hezbollah won.
And let me ask you one other question, and that is, as you've said, the Iranian leadership, the president and the supreme leader have both criticized Arab governments in the region for doing nothing against Israel. Iran, though it's far away, Iran does have some capabilities against Israel if it wants to use them. Is anybody criticizing Iran for not doing anything?
No, because Hezbollah is viewed as Iran. I mean, at least through much of the region, when you hear people talk about Hezbollah fighting back, there's an implicit understanding, recognition that this is Iran working through a proxy force, that the weapons, the missiles, certainly the missile that hit the ship, the missiles that are flying in, the level of training, the infrastructure that was built, all that is credited to Iran. Whether or not Iran is taking that credit right now, that's where the credit is going. I'm also not sure the extent to which, and I'm not a military expert, but I'm not sure the extent to which Iran actually has a military capability to attack Israel beyond Hezbollah. I mean, one guy that I spoke to there, again, affiliated with the government, said he doesn't think they do. They have some missiles, but they're not terribly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you start shooting missiles and everything is so close together, you might hit the wrong place.
And does Iran, again, reading between the lines, does the Iranian leadership see this as a proxy war between itself and the United States?
Yes, definitely. They definitely believe that they are the ones being attacked, that Lebanon is nothing but a proxy battlefield, that this is payback by the United States, and that this is the United States' effort to undermine their influence and strategic capabilities in the region. There is also, I'm told, I don't know this firsthand, but I'm told, a growing fear and anxiety that they will be hit.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Ray Takei is a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was born in Iran, is now a United States citizen. He's written widely about Iran, has a new book coming out in October called Hidden Iran: Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. He joins us from the studios of the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
Do you agree with Michael Slackman's reading that this is a proxy war from the Iranian point of view between them and the United States?
Yes, that's right. I think if you look at the commentary that's coming out of Iran, they're suggesting that this is the first and an important campaign launched by the United States and Israel to transform the Middle East to their own strategic benefit. So it's is an episode in a much larger picture of conflict between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of his portrait of Iranian internal politics, does that jibe with what you've been hearing?
Oh, yes, that's right, in a sense that there has long been a cleavage between state and society on issue of support for the Palestinian struggle and, of course, Hezbollah as well, in a sense that many Iranians don't really have that sort of a visceral attachment to the Palestinian or Lebanese struggle. And as Michael was mentioning, they would like to have the resources that the regime devotes to this cause to be spent on domestic economic infrastructure and all the other problems that Iran has. I think most Iranians, if you put it up to a vote, would not support their country giving $1 billion a year in fuel subsidies to prop up the sort of autocratic government of Syria while they have their own fuel shortages, and there's all kinds of discussions, as we mentioned, about potential rationing of petroleum.
And let me ask you both. Iran has ambitions not just to be an important player within the region, but in the world stage as well. Is that not right, Michael Slackman?
Well, definitely. I mean, the leadership of Iran is trying to, has recently been, I think, in Central Asia. But I think more specifically, they're focusing on the region. They're looking to redefine the strategic balance of power in the region away from the traditional capitals of Amman, Riyadh, and Cairo towards Tehran. I think that's rather than global power. I think at the moment that's what they were looking for. And prior to this conflict, I think they felt that they were marching in the right direction, that they were successful.
And is there fear that if this conflict does not turn out the way they'd hoped, that influence might be reduced?
That is an anxiety.
We're going to have to take a short break. Ray Takei will get your response to that in a few minutes. But Michael Slackman, I wanted to thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Michael Slackman is Cairo Bureau Chief for The New York Times, just back from a reporting trip in Tehran, the capital of Iran. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. We'll take your calls after the break. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon claim to have long-range rockets that can reach deep inside of Israel. Experts say the weapons probably come from Iran, which openly supports Hezbollah. Our focus this hour is on Iran's role in the current conflict, what role, if any, it might play in its resolution, and Iran's aspirations in the region as a whole. Our guest is Ray Takei, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, you're invited to join us if you have questions about Iran's role in the current crisis or about its aspirations in the region and beyond. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Ray Takei, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that question I put to Michael Slackman just before the break. What does Iran hope to get out of this?
Well, I think Iran doesn't really have aspirations to become a global power, but certainly an important actor in the Middle East and in the larger Islamic community beyond the Middle East. And if this crisis yields a Hezbollah that is acclaimed by the not just the Arab street, but the Muslim street, then Iran as its principal advisor, as indeed Hezbollah as a protege of Iran, gets Islamic Republic some political dividend among the inhabitants of the Middle East, certainly, but perhaps even points beyond.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Gary. Gary's calling us from San Diego.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and as always, I appreciate this forum on the air. My question is, most of us here in the West really have very little idea of what goes on inside Iran on a daily basis. And I'm wondering just about whether the government of Iran, the president and the surrounding body, really reflects and represents the will of the people of Iran. And how much of a disconnect is there between the will of people and those who are in power?
On this particular issue, on terms of Iran's involvement in the Arab-Israeli conflict, I think there is a large divergence between the leadership and the public at large. As I think was mentioned in the previous segment, most Iranians are rather indifferent to Palestinian struggle or, for that matter, the Hezbollah's own tribulations. You know, from their perspective, that Iran doesn't have this sort of emotive attachment to this conflict. It doesn't have a Palestinian refugee problem. It is a non-Arab state. So in that sense, the leadership's attachment to this issue, which is 27 years standing, is in contradiction to public sentiments.
Can I ask a quick follow-up then?
Sure, go ahead.
With that in mind, it sounds to me as though you're saying that really the people of Iran aren't necessarily 100% behind it and that the government is sort of asserting its will. I am wondering, really, and as I'm sure many people are wondering and concerned, that this really has all of the elements to widen to a larger global, if not world war, type of scenario. And I would like to get a little bit of feedback.
I think the Iranian government, as well as, frankly, Hezbollah, perceived that this would be a limited conflict, in a sense that Hezbollah would capture a couple of Israeli soldiers and essentially perhaps relieve some of the pressure that was being placed by the Israeli government on the Palestinian Authority, because this crisis has obscured the fact that the Palestinian Authority, the Hamas government, was under considerable military pressure by Israel. So it was essentially perhaps planned as a diversion from that. And I think Iranians probably conceded to that. But as the scope of Israeli retaliation and even potential internationalization of this conflict has come about, I think Iranians and Hezbollah as well are hoping a quick ceasefire and somehow a return to status quo ante, in a sense that Hezbollah retains some of his capabilities and perhaps emerges in a politically more advantageous position. But I think the inclination on part of these governments and this movement in Lebanon at this particular point is to limit the cost of this conflict as opposed to its geographic expansion.
Gary, thanks very much. Let's turn now to Amanda. Amanda's calling us from, I'm not sure how this is pronounced, Cadiz, Kentucky?
It's Cadiz, Kentucky.
Cadiz, that's the other way it could go. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is this. The Middle East is fairly, you know, interconnected in terms of its politics. And with the recent United States government support of the Shia government in Iraq, how much of this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel is a response to, you know, the pushing aside of the Shiite, considering Iran has a formidable Shiite population?
Well, we're witnessing in the Middle East today a unique phenomenon, namely the empowerment of the Shi'i community. Obviously, in the case of Iraq, certainly in Iran is a majority Shi'i community, some 90%. And even in Hezbollah, its case itself, Hezbollah has always been one of the leading representatives of Lebanon's Shi'i community in the sort of a multi-confessional Lebanese state. However, for a long time, the Shi'i empowerment was coming through electoral process, being elected in Iraq and similarly in Lebanon as well. I think Hezbollah's incursion into Israel and the Israeli response perhaps potentially could diminish its political appeal to non-Shi'i members of the Lebanese community, in a sense that Lebanon had finally reclaimed its independence from Syrian occupation, was trying to devote its economic resources to rebuilding the national infrastructure after the long period of civil war in that country, and suddenly, for the third time, Beirut is destroyed again, and the catalyst for that destruction is Hezbollah. Now, in the long term, I think that'll redound to its political disadvantage.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Amanda.
You're welcome.
As this continues, and by the way, I mentioned that earlier this hour, Hassan Nasrallah threatened to launch missiles against Tel Aviv if Israel continued to attack in Beirut, and Israel has responded with threats of its own. It should be noted Israel rarely issues empty threats either, that if Tel Aviv was attacked, it would destroy Lebanon's infrastructure. So this does go on. Can you talk for a moment with us about the relationship of Hezbollah and Iran? Is Hezbollah a creation of Iran? To what degree is it independent?
the relationship between Iran's clerical community and the Lebanese Shi'i community actually predates the Iranian Revolution. They're the relationship that were forged in seminaries, bonds often tied with marriage, and so on. Hezbollah came to scene in the aftermath of Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, when Iranians began to organize the Shi'i community that had largely been passive and excluded from Lebanese political system and privileges of power. So it was Iranian Revolutionary Guards in conjunction with activist clerics in Lebanon that actually created Hezbollah. Since then, Hezbollah had gone on to assume its own identity and has exercised a degree of autonomy from the Iranian leadership. Hezbollah has a dual identity at this particular point. On the one hand, it is a political party. It has seats in the parliament, representation in the Lebanese cabinet. It operates a rather extensive social network in terms of schools, hospitals, and so forth. So it's very much part of the Lebanese society. Yet on the other hand, Hezbollah has always also been a vanguard Islamist organization, very much animated by an anti-Israeli, anti-Zionist impulses. I think to suggest that Hezbollah is a sort of a automatic actor of Iran in a sense that it takes direction from Iran is to misread how this party has evolved since its creation, admittedly, with Iranian assistance some 24 years ago.
Let's get another caller in on the line. This is Roger. Roger calling from Lexington in South Carolina. Hello, Roger. Are you there? I think Roger has left us, so we'll hang up on Roger and turn to Syed. Syed is calling from Green Bay in Wisconsin.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that the Iranian people have no inherent dispute with Israel or the Jews. In fact, historically, we have more of a dispute with Arabs than we do with Jews. We are the descendants of Cyrus the Great, proud of our heritage of multiculturalism and pluralism. We are the society in which Muslims and Jews coexisted and lived in peace side by side until the Islamic Republic of Iran came in 1979. The vile anti-Semitism that is articulated by the Ayatollahs in Iran, in fact, is offensive to the national identity of Iran and the Iranian heritage. Hezbollah is the enemy of the Iranian people. Hezbollah has conducted assassinations of over 200 Iranian freedom fighters and dissidents in the decades of the 1980s and 1990s all over Europe.
And is there a question in there, Syed?
Just my comment.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. He did raise one point, and that is Iran's relationship with the Arab states, which has not always been easy. They certainly supported Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War.
That's true. And the relationship between Iran and the Sunni Arab powers has actually in some ways worsened since the American invasion of Iraq in March 2003 and the resulting empowerment of the Shi'i community. The monarch of Jordan, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, and most recently Hosni Mubarak of Egypt have all warned that the rising Shi'i resurgence benefits Iran and that all these political parties, whether they're in Iraq or Lebanon, are sort of a subsidiaries of the Iranian government. I think that's rather exaggerated. But nevertheless, there's anxiety in Sunni capitals of the Middle East that as a result of, frankly, American action and as a result of American insistence on sort of democracy promotion, that is resulting in this sort of a resurgence of the Shi'i bloc and a sort of a Shi'i crescent even. And the leadership of that crescent lies in Tehran. As I mentioned, that's a sort of a paranoid style of Arab politics, but nevertheless, the divisions between the Islamic Republic of Iran and some of his Sunni neighbors is beginning to be even more tense.
And, of course, there are important Shia minorities, a majority, of course, in Iraq, but minorities in places like Kuwait, Bahrain, the Gulf states.
And in Bahrain, there is actually the Shia majority. And certainly Kuwait has a sizable Shia minority, and Saudi Arabia has about 15% Shia community, but that is situated rather strategically in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which tend to have many lucrative oil facilities. And historically, these Shi'i communities have not been well integrated into the society, much less the political life of these organizations. They're largely viewed and treated as second-class citizens. And as such, now that they're looking across the border to an emerging strong Iran and increasingly to the Shia brethren in Iraq reclaiming political power, the fear is that that could stimulate their own aspirations.
Our guest is Ray Takei, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His forthcoming book is called Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And speak to us, if you would. We were talking earlier with Michael Slackman of the New York Times and about the Iranian leadership and about the various sources of power. Who's in charge and what are the various factions or groups that are that influence governmental policy?
The Islamic Republic is and has always been a coalition government in a sense that there have always been sort of competing centers of power. Even in the era of conservative consolidation, as has taken place since 2004. Today, of course, there's a strident and a very harsh ideologue in terms of Iranian president that in some way uneases the elders of the revolution, the clerical community, and so forth. There's a great deal of ideological commonality between them, but sometimes his style tends to be rather concerned to them. It's hard to say how much support this Iranian government has. Estimates are it has 10 to 15% of the population that is ardently supportive of the government, but it's a 10 and 15% of the population that can immobilize and put into street. It has rather developed coercive capabilities and rather strong and nationwide intelligence capability. So it has some degree of domestic stability. Iran has structural economic problems in the sense that it has demographic issues, and as Michael was mentioning, it has seriously dilapidating oil infrastructure, which is fairly bad for a country that relies on oil as its principal source of revenue. But at this particular point, both economically and politically, the Iranian government is rather stable.
What is the relationship between this crisis, between Hezbollah and Israel, Iran and the United States, if you will, and the coincidental or maybe not so coincidental crisis between Iran and the United States and its allies on the Security Council, who are giving Iran until August 31st to respond to a Security Council resolution demanding that it stop uranium enrichment?
Actually, it's quite impossible to answer that question because it's sort of presumes some sort of a foreknowledge of the operational discussions between the Hezbollah movement and the Iranian patrons. I suspect that there was some perceptions within Tehran that this crisis could divert attention from Iran's ongoing dispute with the international community on its contested nuclear program. In the long run, it may work out that way, but just this week, Security Council passed another resolution demanding Iranian compliance with its IAEA obligations. So the process of the United Nations, the bureaucratic processes, are continuing to go forward, irrespective of this crisis. It hasn't thwarted those efforts. I think the most recent Security Council vote was 14-1. However, in the long run, if as a result of this crisis, there is a divergence between the United States government and at least the European public opinion. And that certainly seems to be the case. Mm-hmm. And the European public opinion pushing the European governments to distance themselves from the American government and its rather staunch support for Israel. The question that the European governments will face, and the Russians and the Chinese as well, in the next several months, is would they want a third crisis in the Middle East? There's a crisis in Iraq in a sense that the country is uneasily in descending into a civil war. There is a crisis in the Israeli-Palestinian-Lebanese front that even the stabilization of this particular conflict is not going to remove in a sense that the Gaza and the Palestinian Authority are still a mess, and who knows what the nature of the multinational force on the Israeli-Lebanese border would be, even if such force manifests itself. So does the international community, do the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians want to open up a third crisis and a potential confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program? That's a question they will have to decide for themselves in the next several months. And I think the crisis in Lebanon may work in that sense in the Iran's advantage, in a sense that there's a crisis fatigue in the Middle East today.
Ray Takei, thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you.
Ray Takei, a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His forthcoming book, Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. He joined us from the studios of the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington. When we come back from a short break, the head of PBS calls out the FCC over indecency fines. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.